This subject really grieves me. It really grieves me. I don't enjoy giving this. I don't enjoy studying this, but I also feel called to it. So I just, after looking back over the past 10 years and speaking on gender at the national conference, I realized that the march towards irrationality is going at neck-breaking speed. And what once was a novelty, bizarre, and even considered entertaining in American culture has not only become acceptable but celebrated. Those who don't concur are considered bigoted and even dangerous. And I would have a picture of some of the past things that you've seen, such as Chaz Bono on Dancing with the Stars. That was back when I first started speaking on this. And then a child called Jazz Jennings, who was one of the first children to be interviewed on I Am Jazz with Barbara Walters in 2007. And she's pretty much an internet celebrity YouTube teenager now because of her the transition to a transgender girl. And then the Canadian couple. How many people remember the Canadian couple that had a baby named Storm? And Storm, they did not tell the child's gender at birth because they wanted the child to decide for herself. She is a female, and she decided she wanted to be a female and come out as a female when she was 5. Her sister, or her brother, who is now a transgender girl, has was interviewed and now 13 years old. This transgender girl says that she really likes being different. Her name's Jazz also. And she says what she really likes about being a transgender girl is that she's really good at sports. So I ask, and many of us have to ask, have we lost our minds? Or are we losing our minds that live in a culture that deny reality and insist that we teach our children and grandchildren to deny their first thoughts and understanding of biological facts, unhinging reality and holding that one reason and sensory perception should be disconnected? We are living in a culture that promotes the idea that male and female are not necessarily designed for each other, implying that procreation of the next generation is separate from sexual design. Even more insidiously, teaching that one can have a female soul and a male body, as if human beings have a biological sex that doesn't really matter, but then matters so much that one would chemically alter and mutilate one's body to fit into a culture that changes their mind on a whim. This is a denial of reality and the human ability to understand and steward our world, a denial of what it means to be a human steward. In August, my good friend and fellow graduate of SES, Simon Brace, called me and sent me an email. Many of you may know him, but he was very alarmed because of what was being, I don't know why I'm holding this, but was very alarmed because of what was going on in South Africa. And he said, here's what he sent me. He sent me the Comprehensive Sexuality Curriculum. How many have seen this curriculum? Anybody? Okay. It confirms what we already know. This is what's being done in South Africa, where poverty is probably the biggest issue, but this is what's being promoted. It confirms what we already know, that ideology is replacing truth, that the Comprehensive Sexuality Education Curriculum is promoted and funded by the Office of the UN Commission for Human Rights, Sexuality Information Education Council of the United States, UNICEF, the Kinsey Institute, and International Planned Parenthood Federation. It is presently in 170 countries and all 50 states. Designed and revamped between 2009. Okay. Right here. Okay. What is this?
That's got to plug into your phone. We're going to try to fix it.
Okay.
But you'd have to signal them.
Oh, signal. Signal. I need to signal you? Is that right? You just did it. Okay. 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 Thank you. Forgive my ignorance here. Okay. So it is presently in 170 countries and 50 states, designed and revamped between 2009 and 2011 to ensure gender equality, sexual human rights, and reproductive health services globally through 6,500 Planned Parenthood service points internationally, a multi-billion dollar industry. The curriculum is in full force and coming to a school near you, if not already there, under many, many innocent-sounding names, such as family life education, abstinence plus education, anti-bullying programs, reproductive health education. At the end of my presentation, I'm going to put up the 15 harmful elements and two websites that you really need to see so that you can do something about it, okay? I thought that was more important than my talk, but I am going to give you my talk, okay? So at this point, you can change the slide. When I do that, change the slide. Thank you. Okay, so my talk here is, does gender matter? And in this talk, I'm going to discuss some of the most fundamental questions that can be asked, such as, what does it mean to be human? What, if anything, does maleness and femaleness convey about reality? Is marriage, one man and one woman, an outdated concept for the 21st century? Does the biblical model of gender allow mankind to flourish? And we're going to also, if you see at the top, it shows some things I'm going to talk about. Materialism and theism, reality and natural law. Yeah, go to the next one. Yeah, reality and natural law. I may have extra slides in here because I don't know where this is coming from, but that's good. So I'm going to talk about materialism and relativism and how theism is congruent with reality, is actually congruent with reality. And so to begin with, I want to talk a little bit about what has been the prominent idea of the day, which is materialism. I say has been. Materialism is that which holds that all that exists is matter or energy that produced matter. Okay, so if I were a true materialist, then I would hold that we are just sensory machines, or at best, we are bundles of DNA biochemical machines. But I'm not a materialist because I don't think it matches the world we live in, where people know something about truth, beauty, liberty, equality. We know that real evil exists, right? We know something about justice. These ideas are immaterial ideas, but they are derived from a real objective world. That's how we function as human beings. So let's talk first about materialism. That's fine. Leave it there. That'll work. So if you know about what a consistent materialist would hold, someone like Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins, that because we are human beings, we are not in control of all of our desires, our character, our various neurological functions, we are not free to act morally. We're not morally culpable because we're not really in control of our bodies or who raises us, so we really shouldn't be morally culpable. So someone such as James Holmes, who entered a movie theater in Colorado during the Batman premiere and shot a bunch of people, would be free from guilt of responsibility if he killed for the thrill of it, for revenge, or as a person with a brain tumor affecting his cognitive ability. If we were not culpable for our actions, then James Holmes would not have been held culpable for his actions, but he was. Why is it that we knowingly choose to do what is wrong and we are guilty and held accountable for doing so? John Lennox answered that by saying, if, after all we are is DNA and we dance to its music, why is it that most of us do know and do care about what is going on in the world? Why is it that we care? And so I think that right there shows that, you know, even in the world of materialism, we understand there's something more to humanity. C.S. Lewis said, the Christian and the materialist hold different beliefs about the universe. They both can't be right. The one who is wrong will act in a way which simply does not fit the real universe. Consequently, with the best will in the world, the one who was wrong will be helping his fellow creatures to their destruction. Thomas Aquinas said, although the rest of nature blindly pursues its end, human beings are capable of rational thought, making them the highest sort of creatures in nature. There is a natural law that is directed toward the end of human flourishing, well-being, living well, fulfilling the end of being a human being, not just avoiding pain and not just pursuing pleasure. So what is it about human beings that's so special? Well, here we are. Y'all are listening to me, hopefully. And as you listen, you're going, is what she's saying matching reality? Is it true? Because you have this capacity, and I have this capacity. We have this capacity to communicate, right? So our communication should match reality, so you understand what I'm saying. We know that humans have an ability to apprehend our world, and we have a will to use what we understand and to act on it. That's called stewardship. Would you agree with that? As Christians, we know, and also the rest of the world operates this way. We make decisions based on what works with the world. So, our scriptures back that up in Genesis 1 when God says that we are to, we're stewards made in his image, male and female, that we are to rule, subdue our world. Correct? Okay. But then we know that even after the fall, human beings have the capacity to know what is real and to steward what is real. Okay. So Romans 2 says that we have a conscience that convicts us. And we, if we follow the natural law that's written in our heart, we actually, you know, can do certain things, that we make good decisions and we want to flourish, even though we are still marred by sin. But we know that we all suppress truth. We've all suppressed truth in various ways, as Romans 1 says, and we all behave in unnatural ways. Okay? Austin Fogarty, who wrote the book book Right and Reason, says man is expected to govern over his conduct by reason. Does that match reality? Would you say that matches reality? Okay. Man alone can act according to his nature or against his nature. And this is really where my talk is going. So hear this quote from Austin Fogarty. Humans are naturally driven to strive toward our own personal perceived good end. Would you say that's true? Okay. If our conduct is inhumane, antisocial, or abusive to ourselves or others, our fellow creatures, even if we experience a temporary good, if it is destructive to others or ourselves, it is not truly good. Okay? And that's where civil laws come from. That's where civil laws are made, and they are the lowest rung of morality expected of us so that we can live in community. And hopefully they match value and virtue, human value and human virtue. So even though we break human laws, we do know in our heart when we break them, okay? Good is in accordance with reason. Evil is against reason. Living can be called unnatural because it violates the rules set by nature. This is what is meant by natural law. I would say, and I think we would all agree, that even if someone doesn't believe in a God, they would agree that humans are made in a unique way in the world, that we make a decision to unite as a man and wife. We make that decision, and then there's possibility of procreation. But we are making a conscious decision, unlike the rest of the species. Man alone produces in the world in a unique way, and we have the responsibility of the stewardship of our bodies. Man has the ability and accountability to properly steward the resources of the planet and exercise dominion over it. We don't expect beavers to build skyscrapers. We don't expect dogs to know which side of the road to walk down. Let's keep it real simple, right? Okay, so what does it mean to be made in the image of God? All right, so if you see up there, and I'm not going to have my pretty clicking in and out, so I'm sorry about that. You're going to see things that were not moving, or are not moving, that were moving, so I hope you can follow what I'm saying here. But anyway, I'm going to try to see it this far. So what happens is that when we are made in God's image, we understand God is way beyond us. He is infinite, limitless. He is not contingent, not derived, not dependent. He is all-knowing, all-powerful. He created everything out of nothing. So what is it about the finite human being that makes us in his image? Well, we do know that we've been given a limited time and space to actually make a difference in the world. We have the ability to make decisions that do stand on a limited basis. Okay, so we have a conscience and we have a personality that sets us apart from the rest of creation. We also have a mind to know what something is and what something ought to be. Okay, and we have this power, this will to use it. We have a finite body with five senses that picks up what's going on in the objective world. And with this rational mind that we have been given in the image of our Creator, we take these things and we reason how to take care mostly of ourselves and steward what we own. So this is called a soul-body unity, hylomorphism. In other words, a human being has a soul-body, two sides of a single coin. That's what a human being fundamentally is, that separates us from the rest of the species. This soul with a will and a mind that picks up things from around our environment and knows how to steward it. So we might start out as little kids eating bark, but hopefully by the time we're two or three, we've actually started eating the little green balls that someone calls peas. Okay? So we're starting to learn how our world really works with some guidance from those who've tried to eat bark before. And in doing that, what we're doing is we're actually stewarding what we are. Here's a simple example. I'm riding down the road. A ball rolls out into the street. I don't even have to think one second, and I slam on the brake, right? Because what is it that I know? There's something behind that ball, right? That ball might mess up my car, and that wouldn't be good stewardship. But more importantly, there may be a human being behind that ball that hasn't reached the age of consciousness to stop, right? So I slam on the brake. That's stewardship, and we do it 24/7 while we're awake as human beings. We make that decision. And again, as I said, the human being is the only species who actually makes a decision to do that without even thinking about it, just like that. Well, actually, we do think, but it's so quick that we don't think we're thinking. Now, in his book, Mind and Cosmos, even the prominent atheist Thomas Nagel argues that science alone will never be able to explain a reality that includes human beings. Why aren't we unconscious primates that go about our business? There is no conscious way that materialism could account for things like human consciousness. Now, he got in trouble for saying this. His fellow atheists did not like it. He says there's no account for human consciousness, rationality, or moral values, and yet these things really exist. So does this match our scripture? Well, I think it does. When God created when God finished his creation in Genesis chapter 1, he said, this is very good. It is meant to work for humanity. It is meant to work. And this is how it's going to work. It's going to function the way it was designed to. Okay, so we know that there are 6,500 genetic differences between male and female, 6,500 known genetic differences. We're going to keep it simple, because you can find anything you want to find on the internet. And if you're interested, I have over 100 sources in my bibliography where this talk came from. So X and Y chromosomes actually do mean something. They actually do have a purpose. And they are in every cell of our human body. At the moment of conception, an organized pattern of DNA, one pair of sex chromosomes, is replicated in each cell of the human body. Hormones and surgery cannot change this. At 6 weeks of gestation, the male child is bathed in testosterone. His tissues, his muscles, his organs, all of his system is bathed in testosterone. That's probably why Jazz is so good at sports, you see. There's something that has to do with with the child's Y chromosome. Okay, so what does that do? It makes a male more compartmentally focused. and more he's more optimized for systems. He asks where this is, what this is, and how do I conquer this goal? Okay? This is part of how he was made, the left and right side of the brain being less connected. I'm sorry, men. But as it goes, men tend to be goal-oriented and more aggressive because that's what testosterone actually does. So he tends to say, that is his predominant hormone. So this is, I thought, very interesting and proven to be true when I ride with my husband, that men have what's called M ganglion cells in their eyes. And these are caused by the Y chromosome only. And it gears him for motion and direction. Okay? If you notice, when I'm riding with him, I'm very nervous. But he's more nervous when he rides with me. And I can say that he won't ride with me. But the whole point of what I'm saying is, look at anthropology, look at history, look at neurobiology, look at sociology. Where have men been successful since the beginning of time? Exploration, defense, protection. And how are their bodies geared? They're geared that way. Okay, they're more aggressive. Now, here's we're going to talk about the real interesting part, the female. The female has an excess of X chromosome, and she has this excess, she has this extra fallback gene, which makes us have more diversity among females. We have an integrated personality, more interwoven, the left and right side of the brain. We don't have more emotions than men, they're just more highly connected. Okay, so we are optimized for optimized for personal need. We are nurturers. Now, I'm going to give you a recent study that shows you this. But what I first want to say is that who is the only one who can actually conceive a child? A female. Who is the only one who can actually nurse a child? A female. So it makes sense that the Creator would give the female oxytocin, which bonds her to her family and makes her driven to do that. She has P ganglion cells in her eye, which also makes her detect texture and color more quickly and drawn to the intimate face-to-face humanity. Interesting, because she's going to give this face-to-face look when she's nursing her child. And here is what was recently discovered. That's good. Okay, so what happened recently is that this article actually came out in the Boston Globe July 7th, but it's talking about brain studies, okay? So here's one of the brain studies. Jody Pulaski and her research team at the University of Rennes in France focused on what she and her colleagues call the neglected neurobiology of the maternal brain. She said it is one of the most significant biological events of a person's life. She says women experience a flood of hormones during pregnancy, childbirth, and breastfeeding that primes the brain for dramatic changes in regions of thought to make up the maternal circuitry, making her fiercely protective and a motivated caregiver focused on the baby's survival and well-being. Researchers suspect that these effects linger long after shaping her relationship with her future grandchildren. After childbirth, the volume of gray matter in the mother's brain changed dramatically, particularly in the regions involving social processing and theory of the mind. The ability to attribute emotions and a mental state to other people, key in raising humans. Again, this was reported in the Boston Globe, not in Christianity Today. Okay? The researchers also scanned men who became fathers during the study period and those who did not have a child and found there was no comparable change in the brain, in the gray matter. Go figure. Okay. So there's also a recognition in the gaps of understanding how men and women differ, says the American College of Physicians. In May, they issued a call to close the gap by including more women subjects in clinical research and regularly reporting gender-specific data and the result of those studies. I wonder how that's going to go for them. Okay, because we know that when something is not politically correct, it's often not reported. I think you can go to the next one. I'm not quite sure. Okay, yes. So what is it about the woman says, the Center for Developing Child, mine doesn't come up, so the Center for Developing Child at Harvard University said, healthy development in the early years provides the building blocks for educational achievement, economic productivity, responsible citizenship, lifelong health, strong communities, and successful parenting of the next generation. Early experience builds brain architecture. This is what happens when a mother is face-to-face with her child, nursing her baby. This lays the groundwork, this serve-and-return interaction, and because she is the one who can relieve toxic stress, which if you've ever had a screaming baby, you know what toxic stress is all about, is unrelieved, and this stress is relieved by the mother who is equipped by her biological body to do these things. This is backed up by the famous Margaret Mead, who y'all probably know is a 20th century anthropologist, not particularly conservative, we would also add, but she studied over 1,000 cultures, in fact, thousands of cultures, and she says women just experience their body more as a more firmly integrated part of their personality. Men, she said, experience their bodies as a tool to be cared for and used. You men can ask yourself if that sounds good. She says, men have to learn to want to beget children and to cherish children and to maintain a society in which children are provided for as well as simply protected against enemies. She says, this is an essential aspect of humanity, includes the functions that allow the continuation of the species. Philip Longman wrote this when he worked for the Carnegie Institute, which is also not a very conservative think tank, and the New American Foundation. He says, it takes a great deal of cultural capital to encourage young men to marry and fulfill the responsibility of husband and father. Present culture shows the good life does not include fatherhood with its commitments and responsibilities. When men take marriage and fatherhood with little significance, as many will, they will avoid marriage altogether and fatherhood. Fatherhood pushes men to be responsible husbands and fathers and holds men accountable for the care, protection, discipline, and nurture of the next generation. In such a society, irresponsibility in the task of parenthood is seen as a fundamental threat to society. Okay, these are two anthropologists, sociologists, who we would say were not particularly Christian persuaded. So, what does our scripture say? I think our scripture matches this. In Genesis chapter 2, God said it was not good for the man to be alone, that he would create a helper according to the opposite of Adam. Now, I think Dr. Walt Larmore in his book, and he's a brain surgeon, wrote the book His Brain, Her Brain, and he said that, and I think his definition is really good, this is not the little woman behind him. This is not the little woman beside him looking out at the goal to conquer. This is the woman across from him, face to face. She is his perfect match. She is superbly dovetailed, ally, and accomplice. She is attuned to him and is gifted so that her strengths match his weakness and her vision matches his blind spots and vice versa. No wonder God said it was not good for man to be alone. And we see Paul repeating this in 1 Corinthians 11, verses 11 and 12, where he talks about the necessary interdependence of male and female in the family and in the church, and I would say in the community and in the business world. We balance each other. That's how the design was made for stewardship. Charles Colson said, rather than being an arbitrary set of rules and restrictions that repress and distort our true nature, Christianity actually describes our true nature and shows us how to live according to it. We pay a high price for denying this reality. When we live according to God's truth, we enjoy the fruits of operating the way we were created to. Human beings flourish best with a primary caregiver who is an intimate nurturer, and a secondary caregiver who is a protector. This is nature's provision. Our biology provides these natural proclivities. Would you agree? Okay. So we say, well, that's great. That's some science. That's materialism. But materialism is incomplete because there's more to the story. Now we've swung to the opposite direction, postmodernism or relativism, where our culture wants us to go beyond objective biology, which I think we do need to go beyond objective biology, but now we're going way beyond where now biology doesn't matter at all, that we want to live beyond our biology. So what this is what transgenderism is about. It denies the reality of sense perception and necessarily claims a disconnection between the human soul and body. Again, at death is when the soul-body separates. So we don't have a separate soul, separate body. These always operate as one because the sensory body is picking up from the environment what reality has set as boundaries, and it unites with our rational minds and we can reason and steward. Dr. Paul McHugh, former psychiatrist in chief at Johns Hopkins and the first to venture into sex reassignment surgery in the 60s and 70s, they don't do that surgery at Johns Hopkins anymore, points out that changing one's sex is impossible. Transgender people do not become the opposite sex. They become feminized men or masculinized women, and that lies their problematic future. It proves not easy nor wise to live in counterfeit garb. He says, you can click it. Studies extending over 30 years in Sweden, where transgender people are highly supported by the culture. Okay, this culture highly supports the transgender culture. 10 to 15 years after surgical reassignment, the suicide rate of those who had undergone sex reassignment surgery rose to 20 times that of their comparable peers. Transgenderism makes the mind the creator of reality. When the thoughts do not correspond to truth, to reality, and make false assumptions, we have a psychiatric disorder. The American Academy of Pediatrics concedes that within its own guidelines, transition-affirming protocol is based on low evidence. The only strong evidence is its potential risk to children. And they go on to say, and I don't know where that is. Keep going. Okay, there you go. So what basically is going on here is they're saying, Dr. McHugh is saying that when someone has surgery to change their sex, it's like someone with anorexia going to have liposuction. Okay, it doesn't change reality. In fact, it would do them grave harm. And here are the dangers, the health risk, again, by the American Academy of Pediatrics, Puberty blockers decrease bone mineralization, cause bone fractures, obesity, testicular cancer, and an unknown impact on cognitive and psychological development. Cross-sex hormones, cardiac disease, high blood pressure, blood clots, stroke, diabetes, and cancer and sterilization. Scientific evidence, of course, shows that those under 21 cannot really assess the risk if they start taking these drugs when they can be prescribed around age 11. They can start doing that. And of course, then if you have surgery, genital or mastectomy, that can be done at 16 or 18, which then destroys the function of the organ in itself. The fact that in normal life and in psychiatry, anyone who consistently and persistently insists on anything else contrary to physical reality is considered either confused or delusional. Okay, yeah. In September, Russell Toomey published this peer-reviewed article. It was peer-reviewed in the Journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics. That's the American Academy of Pediatrics. One in two biological girls, 50%, who identified as boys, tried to kill themselves this year. 50%. Okay, this is not a Christian. This is a guy who is very sympathetic to the movement, and he found this, and it was in a peer-reviewed article, 50% of transgender boys, girls who are trying to become boys, tried to kill themselves. 50%. 2 in 5 gender non-conforming adolescents tried to kill themselves, and 3 in 10, or 30%, of biological boys who identified as girls tried to kill themselves this year. Right before this came out, another alarming article came out from Brown University, Lisa Littman. Has anyone seen that article? Probably not, because it was taken down the day it went up. Right, because it was not politically correct, where she documents the rapid onset of gender dysphoria. This is a certain type of gender dysphoria, which happens very quickly, not like children who, you know, say they're a girl at 3 and decide to transition at 13. She's talking about here a rapid onset within days or weeks of teens being exposed to peers who identify as transgender or who are exposed to transgender positive content online. And of course, it was immediately taken down. So it shows somewhat what's going on with teenagers, which we understand is sort of a faddish thing, where there might be true disease such as anorexia nervosa, where someone wants to be bone thin because they see models. People wanting to have this unique identity because they want to be different. Whereas different but not different, okay? Different in that the culture is becoming more and more approving of this, and it's different to be different. So materialism says all that matters is your DNA and that we just dance to its music. Postmodernism or relativism says is a denial that the objective world actually sets boundaries for what something can be. All that matters is what I think, what I feel from day to day. Both ideas are incomplete. Transgenderism denies male and female biological design, and homosexuality also denies the body's sexual design has an inbuilt purpose. Male and female organs are unitive and potentially procreative. Humans can intervene by choice. Why? Because we have the capacity to do so. We have the freedom to choose against what a thing would be if left to operate by its inbuilt design. But it would be unnatural for a human being to cut off a limb, to gouge out an eye, or to remove a breast for anything other than disease. Yet this is explicitly seen in transgenderism, where sexual organs with their inbuilt purposes are denied. This article, next one, came out in 2016 by the American Medical Association Journal of Ethics, where they are promoting transgender rights. But this is what they said in summary after their report. In summary, born that way articles on behalf of transgender rights are easily undermined on the basis of 2 things, reason and scientific data. Supporters of transgender rights should avoid these arguments. They are logically flawed and fail to acknowledge the current scientific evidence about gender identity. To be gendered is, to be human is to be gendered. Male and female were shaped for better or worse by a male and female, who were shaped for better or worse by a male and female. This is the center of the human story, and it means the choices we make in living out our masculinity and femininity matter profoundly. They touch everyone around us, says Glenn Staunton in his book, Secure Daughters and Confident Sons. The duty, and I hope you keep asking yourself, does this match reality? Does this match reality? The duty of rearing children belongs to 2 people, one male and 1 female. This is nature's provision for the human being. How else did they get there? How else can they get there? No society has ever figured out how to raise healthy boys and girls into thriving men and women without fathers and mothers in this essential human task. Does this match our scripture? Well, it does. Jesus said, have you not read that from the beginning the Creator made them male and female? Yes. that the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and will be united with his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. So there is a natural obligation for this decision to become united with another human being. There is a natural obligation because it actually puts you in a position where you are committing to this person. And if there are children that are procreated, you have a natural obligation to them. And guess what? They have a natural obligation to you as adults. Adult children have a natural obligation to their parents. Can you see how that would cause humanity to flourish? Okay, so we're going to look a little bit. We know that the creation was marred by sin in Genesis chapter 3, and we're all part of that. But the marriage is a picture of this restorative process. And Robert George said in his book, Robert George said in his book, What is the Good of Marriage? First, unlike friendship, marriage unites people in all their basic dimensions. It involves a union of minds and wills that unfolds in a sharing of resources. But marriage includes bodily union. Now listen, this is because your body is an essential part of you. It is not a vehicle driven by the real you, your mind. It is not a costume that you wear. Your body is not a costume that you wear. Here, this is Jay Budashevsky. One condition that makes the mutual gifts of selves possible is that the two selves have something to give. They complement each other. This is possible because there is something missing in the man, which he finds in the woman, and something missing in the woman, which she finds in the man. Would you say that was true? Okay. The only function that is not complete in the human being is the sexual union reproduction function. That is the only function that is not complete on its own. Your respiratory system is self-contained. Your digestive system is self-contained. You get the picture? Your sexual function is not self-contained. This is incomplete. This incompleteness is a blessing. First, because it makes it possible for male and female to give themselves to each other. It's unitive. And second, because it gives them a motive to do so. The single biological could, the biological union occurs many times in marriage, thousands of times in a healthy marriage, when conception does not occur. This is to make marital love concrete and binding. Okay, so it has a purpose way beyond what we give it credit for. And the human being is the only one of the species that has a face-to-face sexual union. And women, in particular, are drawn to a face-to-face union with their partner. That's how we're created. We desire that. And so this face-to-face knowing of each other is only possible because of our design, our physical design. Did you know that in Genesis chapter 1, all the creatures are told to multiply, but none of them are called male and female? We know they're male and female because we have the ability to reason. But they are called male and female about the human steward, and the words male and female used there actually describe the physical female body and the physical male body in Greek and in Hebrew. This union was, these words are specifically chosen there. So, by nature, only one woman and only one man are capable of becoming one flesh. Only a unitive act can generate life. We are created to live in community, and marriage is the most intimate of these communities and the foundation of society. Fathers and mothers are both needed to raise a child because the male is best suited for protection and the female is best suited with her natural biological proclivities for nurturing. Both are needed to teach the child because the child needs a model of his own sex, a model of the opposite sex, and a model of the union and relationship between them. Dr. Jennifer Roebuck Morris, in her book, Love and Economics, says that to deprive a child of his mother or father is the greatest human rights violation she knows of. Okay? So, go back one. I'm sorry. I've got two. Okay. So this is how our scriptures back this up. When God created the first man and woman, he fashioned them into two patterns. The first pattern was his own image. The second pattern was Christ and his church. The first model explains our humanity, God's image, which we individually possess as reasoning men, as reasoning women. The second model explains our sexuality, with the male taking Christ's part and the female taking the part of the church. Both of these are basic to human design. The gospel is a stumbling block to our culture that values self over service and feelings over truth. What natural law hums as a song of order and design, the words of our scripture put our scripture put words to that song, describing healthy human marriage as the living picture of redeemed believers walking in oneness with Christ. That's what Ephesians 5 is all about. Okay? Do we expect the church to accept that? Yes, we do, because it is the gospel. Paul talks about it as being a picture of the gospel. Okay? But do we expect our culture to accept it? Well, yes and no. Yes, because guess what? Marriage laws ensure the well-being of children, men, and women. It commits them to each other and to take responsibility for their own sexual behavior. Every society has found its way to the establishment of male and female marriage as a central institution of all social order. So, what happened in the 60s and 70s in this country when no-fault divorce came in? What happened before that, divorce was an adversarial proceeding because someone had committed adultery, a felony, or abandoned their spouse. But now you can just not like each other and get a divorce. By law, separating sexual conduct from moral responsibility. So what happened is we have a disconnect between sexual behavior. This came up, sexual behavior and moral responsibility, several years ago. Yes, this is an extreme case, but there was a man who had 24 kids with 11 women. He wants a child support break. He presently pays $1.47 per child per month. Okay, these children's father is the government. You understand that, right? Okay, and I feel sorry for these 24 children. I really do. But as Robert George said in his book, A Nation of Singles, he says, marriage is helpful to all of society, married and unmarried. Did you know children who are born in a single family have an 80% higher likelihood of being victims of child abuse, being victims living in poverty, or ending up in prison? 58% now of firstborn children are born out of wedlock in this country. 58% firstborns. Of all children, 42%. That's a pretty large number. So what do children do when they see their parents partnering and repartnering? Okay. If adults do it, children are going to do it too, right? Teens are going to do that, okay? So there's some consequences for that. Again, toxic stress is what is caused by the breakup of a family, but this came out in the Journal of Neuroimaging, I think it was 2014. It says that psychiatric disease is the biggest cause of human disability in the world. These findings are important because exposure to family adversity in childhood and adolescence from birth to 11 poses the biggest risk factor for later psychiatric disease. Okay, so we're talking about stress, psychiatric disease, but here's an even more startling statement made by CNN. I found this article about the CDC. The CDC estimates that there are more than 20 million new cases of STDs in the United States each year. There are 110 million cases of STDs presently in the United States. You say, how can there be that many? There are only 30 million people. How can there be 110 million cases of STDs? Because some people have two or three, okay? But 20 million new cases per year, okay? And so this 20 million new cases per year is pretty startling. And the upsetting thing is that 50% of them are among people 15 to 24 years old, at a cost of course, many billions of dollars per year in health care. But the saddest thing, in my opinion, is that 71% of the people are young men who have HIV. And this article says that many more of these go undiagnosed and unreported. This is the legacy of the 60s and 70s. We got a problem. We got a problem. We got a problem. The heart of the sexual revolution is a selfish rejection of order. It is a suicide pact. It is an embracement of nothing. What should a man be? No idea. What should a woman be? No idea. Are men and women for one another? What does marriage? Are certain forms of sexual behavior abnormal, unnatural, against human reason? Lisa Munt, keep going. Keep going. Lisa Monday wrote this article, The Gay Guide to Wedded Bliss. You can Google this. I think you'd find it interesting. It's a 10-page article telling heterosexuals what we have to learn, what I have to learn from homosexual relationships, a lesbian relationship. And it says that what we have to learn in this 10-page article is how to share roles, how to share duties 50-50. That's what we have to learn. But at least she is very honest about the statistics. She says, gay couples, men who couple, break up at 2 times more often than heterosexual couples. Lesbian partnerships are at 77% more likely to break up as gay men. Now, who wants to adopt the children? We'll talk about that in a minute. So, what her own statistics show, and she says gay men report this, that they are 82% non-monogamous. 82%. This is their record, their reporting, not mine. She said, gay men have a completely different set of conditions about what marriage is. It means setting rules for having a commitment and setting rules for sex outside of marriage. This is 82%. It is not all, but it is 82%. She goes on to say that gay men typically do not desire to adopt children, typically. Typically, it is lesbians who desire to adopt children. What is our natural proclivity as a female? To be family bonded, right? Women desire to have children and be family bonded. But Lisa Mundy says the reason these lesbian relationships break up at a much higher rate, she says, not me, she says, studies examining children raised by gay women, lesbian women tend to be relationally intense. Really? Okay. Few relationships are able to withstand the relational intensity of two women. Okay, I agree. Lesbian partnerships are 2 times as likely to break up, and children suffer in all the important measures of psychological and emotional and physical well-being when that happens. Society can be said to exist only to the extent to which spousal love remains intact. This is Robert Riley. He says, the courts have seemed to have forgotten that the legal disadvantages against homosexuality and other partnerships were put in place exactly for the purpose of shaping behavior in a certain way to benefit society. That's where civil laws come from, right? Okay. And for discouraging behavior that undermines the family. Okay. So, the day after the Supreme Court came out and legalized gay marriage, the American College of Pediatrics said that the Supreme Court had just undermined the greatest single pro-child institution in the history of mankind, the natural family. The college itself maintained that a significant body of research has demonstrated that same-sex marriage deliberately deprives the child of a mother or father and is therefore harmful. We know that it denies a child of a mother and father. That is necessarily true, but it is necessarily harmful. And here I thought was really a great article answered the New York Times. Ryan Anderson answered the New York Times with their article on the New York Times ignores children of gay parents who want a mom and a dad. They interviewed Katie Faust. She says, the bond with one's natural parents deserves to be protected. Do not fall prey to the false narrative that adults' feelings should trump children's rights. The onus must be on the adults to conform to the needs of a child, not the other way around. Every child is conceived by a mother or a father whom that child has a natural right. Every child raised by two moms or two dads necessarily came into the household by one of four traumatic methods: abandonment by a biological parent, divorce, death, or by donor conception. She says, does being raised under the rainbow flag miraculously wipe away all negative effects and pain surrounding the loss and daily deprivation of one or both parents? Keep going. The scandal of natural law is acute because of the suicidal proclivity of our time to deny the obvious. Man not so much breaks the moral law as the moral law breaks man if he transgresses it. As human beings, we are capable of good reasoning that match reality and foster human flourishing in our society. As Christians, we are called to speak the truth in love, knowing that we must all tolerate and live with the consequences of our own fallen behavior and with that of others. Let us not succumb to the false idea that we must embrace, fund, celebrate, and teach the next generation that all behaviors are equally valid. Materialism, just dancing to our DNA, and relativism, how one feels, trumping objective truth, are both a denial of reality. Both systems are incomplete. Dr. Zacharias said this last year, and young men and women are willing to throw their lives away. This breaks my heart. Throw their lives away for false ideologies. And it is our responsibility as Christians to do the best that God gives us the opportunity to do to keep that from happening. Who's the biggest loser? The next generation. What do we need to be teaching them? Truth. What is truth? That which corresponds to reality. That's what truth is. Humans cannot survive well or long outside of the family structure, and we're not created to do so. But the Christian faith offers a different story, a deeper story, a story of lifelong relationship grounded in faithfulness and launching members on a joint adventure with public and private responsibilities. That's my talk, but I'm going to not end it here, because what I want you to see, if you'll flip one more time, these are the 15 harmful elements of comprehensive sexuality education. This would have to be, if I were to show you the pictures that go with this, we would have to censor them. We would have to censor what's being shown to children in Africa, in South America, in our country. I would not show you some of these pictures in this curriculum. You need to go online, waronchildren.org, or investigate IPPF.org, so you can read about this curriculum that is coming again to a school near you. And I'm just going to say this. We all have things in our life that we need to deal with as Christians. And I don't ever want you to think that I think I'm better than any of these people. I don't. But I'm going to tell you something. We've got a calling to live a life that exalts what our scriptures teach. And guess what? Those scriptures actually match reality, the real world that God created, because the creator of the world and the writer of the scripture are one and the same. And so those things are congruent. So I thank you for your time. I have a bibliography that is about 100 sources that I got this talk to do. So if you would like to get it, you can email me, and I'll have a piece of paper up here for you to sign up and get my bibliography. Yes. I will talk to you about it. Come up and see me. I know there is so much on here, and I will talk to Adam, but I'm willing to give this to you on one condition: that I know who you are and that it's being used correctly. Because what I don't want is it edited or changed in any way. Okay? Thank you so much.